Hey, it's Joe. The Wise Athletes Podcast is essentially only about one thing, athletic longevity. And by that, I mean, of course, to continue to be a strong, resilient, coordinated, motivated, athletically capable person for most, if not all, of a very long life. Easier said than done, eh? It's true that none of us are getting out of here alive, but why must we also suffer the indignity of losing ourselves? Who among us is still what they were? Use it or lose it is the unavoidable law of the land, but now I seem to lose my athletic capabilities faster and faster and then take longer and longer to get them back. To be honest, I don't like where this is heading. The problem isn't just figuring out what to do, it's fitting it all into a life that is already full of obligations and other unavoidable time sucks. So how can I fit it all in? How can I give my body enough stimulus to tell it to hold on to what I've got, while also allowing for enough recovery and adaptation to get the benefits of these efforts? Well, this is a loaded question, and today I am joined once again by Brendan Eakin, muscle researcher and older athlete himself, to help me get to the bottom of it. We cover a lot of ground to give you a lot to think about, and Brendan is one of the bright minds in the space, so enjoy. Yeah, let's talk to Brendan Eakin about achieving athletic longevity. Dr. Brendan Eakin, welcome back to the Wise Athletes Podcast. I think it's been like 4 years since you were on the show.
Time flies, Joe. Thanks for having me back. And thanks for getting up that early in the morning to facilitate my time of day.
Yeah, not a problem. Not a problem. I got to say, nobody can see you, but I'm looking at you on the screen now. What are you, like 25 years old? You look great. How do you do that?
Yeah, well, the secret is I actually haven't got too many gray hairs, I think. Because yeah, I definitely feel my age. But,
You don't have a single gray hair as far as I can tell. So good job. I think it's those good Irish genes. I got some of those. So anyway, I think that's not the only reason that we can take your word for the stuff we're going to talk about today. Let's give the audience a little bit of your background. You are an expert in like skeletal muscle function and adaptation during aging, and you're an older athlete. Am I right about this?
Yeah, so my research over the last 15, 20 years has focused on muscle and how it responds to training and to a certain extent how it responds to inactivity and disuse as well. And we've looked at that from molecular mechanisms. We've looked at it from intervention studies with exercise and or dietary or diet supplement intervention. So lots of different work. And again, across the life course as well. But as you mentioned, also in older adults. My aging athlete persona, if that's what you want to call it, I play Gaelic games, Gaelic football, which is our national sport here. I can't remember if I talked about this on the last time I was on the show, but I won't go into it in too much detail, only that it's a field invasion sport is what we call it. So it looks a bit like soccer, a bit like rugby. And I played that at an elite level for quite some time, into my mid-30s, and I still play, although at a much lower level, but I'm not just giving up the ghost yet. Recently, I joined in an over-40s, we call it Masters football here in Gaelic football, as I said, in Ireland, and I'd always told myself I wouldn't play at that level because it was such a step down, but then I just couldn't quite retire, and then, past the age of 40, and now I'm able to play for that team, so I'm enjoying that. It's a kind of mix of nostalgia with guys that I played with all over the years, but then it keeps me active and keeps me aiming for something when I'm training as well.
I love it. I think that's wonderful. I never had this reluctance to participate in that, but I did also, not in Gaelic football, but in other sports, primarily in cycling sports. But I think competition really focuses your attention very well. And so I think that's great.
Well, the irony, of course, is that, much of what we'll talk about today, I suppose, I'll be talking about how important exercise is and different types of training and everything. And, the subtext is kind of like everyone should be doing it. And then I find myself, if I don't have a team to train with, I find it very hard to do myself. So I can understand why people don't engage with some of this stuff unless they're really motivated.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think we'll touch on some of this stuff again as we get into the topic that I want to talk about. I recently heard you on the Sigma Nutrition podcast, where you have also been before. That was a really great conversation about, I sort of took it as like being about sarcopenia, kind of an overview for the layman of what is available in the science literature and in your own work on like muscle and strength loss and aging. And I think everyone should listen to that. I'll put that in the show notes. Today, I want to talk about something that's different, more relevant to people like me. Because I think sarcopenias for other people. That's not me. I'm not a frail person. I'll never be a frail person. Well, it stalks us all. And that is sort of the end of this path of, you know, failing to do what I want to do means I go there. And so I want to talk about the not failing in what I want to do, which is I want to be, you know, my podcast is all about athletic longevity, right? I want to be an athlete a long time for a long life. So I want to talk about doing that. And of course, having done so for reasons of vanity and, you know, function and enjoying my life, I won't have trouble getting off the toilet. So that'll be a good thing. But it all kind of boils down to this kind of idea that is no revelation to anybody who has ever done anything. I'm not what I was.
Yeah.
I've tried hard to, you know, hang on, but I'm not. And I don't know exactly why. I'm interested in learning from you, you know, why does that happen? Really for the idea of, well, what can I do about that? I mean, maybe there's things that I'm doing wrong that interfere with my body staying how it was. And also maybe there's things that I, because maybe this decline, this change in my body is inevitable and it builds in sort of cycles of dysfunction, like a spiral of dysfunction. How can I interrupt that or slow that or, you know, whatever I can do in order to get that glide path to be as long as possible. Even if it is a downward trend, it's slow and long, you know, not a crash and burn kind of a thing. So anyway, that's kind of what I want to talk about. You think we can do that?
Yeah, I think we can. I think it's an interesting population that we're talking about here, because it's people who are physically active or, you know, engaged in high level training in relative terms, and want to continue to do so for as long as possible. Yet that's not really a population that's very well studied in the literature. So what we get, and, you know, you and I talked offline about, you know, you don't have to stick to only the literature, so I won't do that. But I'll just paint the picture that what we're asking really here is for people who are quite active, which is already a very small part of the population, how do they maintain their function, limit the decline that's somewhat, you know, it's described in the literature as being inevitable. And it's as I said, it's not an area that gets well studied. We have studies of master athletes, usually cross-sectional, where we can describe their physical characteristics or maybe a little bit about their training patterns and so on, but very little of the kind of longitudinal studies that would allow us to say, if you do A, B, and C, as, you know, in your case, in your 60s, still, you know, highly active, you know, what are the things that work and don't work and so on. So I think we'll be speculating a bit, but that'll be the fun part, talking about, you know, what we do and don't know and where we can maybe try and fill in some gaps.
Yeah. And just to put some layman terms onto what I think you were describing, is that the studies by cross-sectional, you mean you look at 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds and 60-year-olds, and then you kind of compare them and you can, you know, assume that if that 40-year-old then became a 50-year-old, then became a 60-year-old, it would be the same. But we don't really know that. No, you know, that there could be all kinds of things confounding that. And what we don't have are these 40-year studies of a person throughout their life who tried to be healthy or tried to be physically active and what happened to that person. Yeah, I'm interested in me. And, you know, I'm not interested in humanity quite as much as I'm interested in me. Each of us here has got their own interest, but, you know, we're trying to do what we can for ourselves to do that thing that, you know, get up as high as you can and then decline as slow as you can. So it goes a long way out into a long life that, you know, as a capable person, I can go back and do Mount Fuji again when I'm 85, you know, like I just did last year, rather than resort to riding on a bus.
Yeah, well, look, I think what you're describing there is the ideal trajectory. You know, the trajectory as it's painted at the moment for kind of our functional capacity throughout our life course is that it peaks sometime in our 30s or 40s, and then it's just inevitable decline. But there, you know, as I said, and you summed it up very nicely, there's very few studies that follow that trajectory over decades. You know, they call them now longitudinal studies of aging. There are a few of them in different countries. And so we're beginning to see different trajectories. You know, one is that kind of classic one I just mentioned, but there are others but it's only, you know, very small numbers of what we're describing here, which is people who might actually continue to develop capacities of fitness into their 50s. And then they build up that, what I think you're alluding to, which is the physiological reserve. You know, basically the higher you can create some component of fitness, the greater capacity you have to lose it, which is a good thing, because ultimately there's a threshold for any level, for any component of fitness, that if you drop below that, that's when, you know, you reduce functional independence. The example you gave of not being able to get off the toilet, you know, these are hopefully in the trajectories you and I are aiming for, that it's very far down the track. But the reality is, because we know that so few people actually engage fully with exercise guidelines in terms of aerobic and strength training, that it's a very small cohort of people that are not very well studied in order to be able to explain, you know, that kind of ideal trajectory that you mentioned.
Yeah. And just for the sake of time, because, you know, we only have a little bit of time together, we're just going to assume that the people listening they already are exercising.
Yep.
They're active. They are dedicated to it. They're going to keep doing it. And what we're just wanting to do is for that audience that has very little, you know, literature to read about themselves, you know, what does an expert like yourself think? You know, even if nobody knows for sure, what do you think? Maybe what little you do know for sure, what does it say? And then we can maybe come up with, like, well, here are some like good ideas, you know, based on what we know, based on what we think, here are some good ideas. And I think what you're describing one of them, which is, look, you get to like peak Joe you know, and maybe it's not the exact same age for everything. Like, what's my peak bone density, and what's my peak muscle mass, and what's my peak reaction time and jumping ability, and, you know, balance, hand-eye coordination, all of these things. And probably I just mentioned like 1% of, you know, the list, all of these things, there's a peak to them that I built up over time. Maybe the peak was when I was 17, and maybe the peak was when I was 40. I don't know, but then that starts to go. And then there's an effort of hanging on to it. So since we're probably past the peak, I'm probably past the peak, but for the younger people, there's a reason to think about this as well. Even though you're not trying to hold on, you're still trying to make your personal best. That's a good idea. You should be doing that, because the higher you can get that peak, then you've got more time, more decline to give. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yeah, that's a great summary. And I like your point that it you know, different components of fitness will peak and will decline at different rates and at different times. And it's, you know, that creates, I suppose, the challenge of what is the training formula that, you know, hits every box that we want. And the question always becomes with training prescription is how much and at what intensity and how often, you know, the kind of fit principle that we talk about. And like I said, we can make some speculation about that depending on which way you want to take the conversation. But yeah, that's at the crux of the issue, is that maintenance, or reaching that peak, then maintenance where we can, you know, what is the formula for that?
Yeah. All right. You know, another thing that I think is important here is this notion of, you know, use it or lose it, right? We've all sort of lived with that our whole lives. It's definitely a thing. The body is a very efficient machine. It doesn't want to be wasteful. You know, its number one priority is don't starve to death. And so anytime you've got some kind of a, you know, physical capability that takes effort, meaning calories, to maintain, and you're not using it, the body's like, don't want to hang on to that anymore. But I've always been able to get it back. And so it didn't really matter that I was sort of inconsistent in my training. I'd get better, and then I'd get worse, and then I'd get right back to where I was, you know, even with like muscle mass, people talk about muscle memory. You know, once you've had built muscle, it's much easier to get that muscle back. And then the science has sort of been back and forth on whether that's true or not. Well, I'm telling you, it's 100% true for me, and still is. But I think it's starting to go away, that ability. So anyway, there's this use it or lose it thing. But one thing that seems to be true maybe you can talk about the science on this, is that I seem to lose it faster now, and it is harder to get it back. So this inconsistency in my training has a much bigger negative effect on me than it used to. And is there truth in this? Is it just me or is it everybody?
No, look, as far as I can tell, it's everybody. And it's, you know, a lot of older athletes report the exact same phenomenon. And we could probably speculate about, you know, molecular mechanisms and you know, effects that aging has on the gene networks and so forth within the muscle itself, because that's ultimately what underpins adaptation, without getting into the weeds too much on those aspects. But it is this idea that you provide a stimulus to the muscle, let's just say in this case, and the muscle will adapt accordingly. And the, you know, the nature of that stimulus, like I said, when we think about the intensity or the duration or the type of contraction, that obviously influences the response. And if those pathways are changed in some way through something to do with the aging process, then obviously the effect of training is not going to be as large. Where this becomes, you know, that's the model. What we're really talking about with the older adults and athletes is that we seem to be unable to do the same volume of training. So we probably don't provide the muscle with the same signal as we used to. There's a question about whether, you know, there are intrinsic changes within the muscle that prevents, you know, signaling and gene expression changes occurring like they would have in younger individuals, even when the training sessions are matched for intensity. But parking that to one side, it seems that most athletes as they age will report not being able to do the same level of intensity. But the biggest factor that I hear reported to me and my contemporaries is the recovery aspect, which is that the time course of recovery is much longer than when individuals are younger. I had this experience myself. It was in fact the most noticeable change that I had as I played as I got older. It's probably about the age of 36 or 37, having played Gaelic football my whole life, all of a sudden. And I say that not in a kind of exaggeration. It did really feel like all of a sudden, my time course of recovery from playing a football match, you know, which was 24 hours, and being able to train the next day, or certainly being able to train at full tilt 48 hours later, all of a sudden it was like 3 days. Then it was 4 days, and it got to the point where I am now, which I can still play, you know, full match at a decent level of intensity, but it takes about 4 days to recover. So my training has become, you know, completely disjointed from that point of view. And I think I think this is what you were kind of getting at, is that when asked to perform, most middle-aged and older and masters athletes can still perform, albeit not at the same level. But it's the recovery and the impact that recovery process has in terms of not being able to train as intensely. And so I guess my overall summary of all of that is that I think as we get a little bit older, we can't quite give the same stimulus to the muscle or to the body as we would have when we were younger. And there's probably some intrinsic mechanisms why the body won't respond as well as it used to. And then there's also the slowing of recovery, which again causes all kinds of issues then when it comes to, again, training prescription and the type of training we can do, the volume of training we can do. And it's that kind of interaction between all of those factors, I think, that probably explains why we find it so challenging as we age to kind of be our younger selves.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that all by itself would explain why I'm not what I was. If I'm not able to train as hard as I used to, well, then my body, you know, I would lose what that extra amount of stimulus that I used to provide, and I no longer do. The adaptation to that, I would lose that.
But I would also make the point, because I think any of us who have been athletes and who've competed, we have that competitor mindset, which is almost like, you know, my next session is going to be my best ever session, or my next season. You know, I was like 37 and 38 thinking I could still potentially get better here. Clearly wasn't the case. But, you know, we kind of have this in our head that we're always getting better. But at some, and as a result, we push ourselves hard. But in the case of, as we get a little bit older, maintenance becomes the kind of key message. And again, athletes don't want to hear that, you know, your best bet here is just to maintain your performance. But that I think is a message, because going back to your use it or lose it principle, if you get injured, so basically if you push yourself, you know, beyond a level that you should, and again, injury is really a case of tissue overload. If you don't recover well and push yourself too hard and you get injured and then you can't train for a while, that training is effectively inactivity, which is, you know, effectively muscle disuse in a lot of cases, and that's going to accelerate the so-called aging process. So, in fact, you know, as I got a bit older in my playing career as well, I became fixated on this idea of don't get injured, which is actually it's a bad mindset to be, because you become kind of conservative. And again, speaking of a team sport here, you kind of become conservative in the way that you play, and that's got knock-on effects as well. But I think as a broader message, the idea of, you know, aiming for maintenance, not pushing too hard, but pushing hard enough to still have a response. But again, as much as possible, avoiding injury, I think is key to kind of being able to maintain, you know, training load and engagement over time.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty fixated on the don't get injured thing as well. and that shows up more in the weight room than anywhere else. Yeah. I remember when I turned 40, I was really sort of terrified that I was on the decline. I was, you know, that what, you know, 40 is so old, you know, at that point I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do anything? And then it turned out I was as strong as I'd ever been in my life. I was as fit, you know, cardiovascularly as I'd ever been in my life. And I was like, oh, this aging thing is like, that's other people.
Well, I'll just interrupt to say, I'll say the exact same thing happened. So, you know, we were periodically tested, you know, throughout every season, and all of the metrics looked good for me, but maybe I just got good at doing the testing, and there were plenty of other declines that were obvious.
Well, in the recovery thing, everybody knows this, you know, that's why how to recover well is sort of like the hottest topic, you know, get when you talk about older athletes, because everybody feels it. And even though you take your 4 days to recover, you can do it great. You can perform very well, maybe better than ever, because, you know, your brain is maybe better than it ever was. And you know, you're smarter than you used to be. But then it's going to take you 4 more days to get back to where you were. And so some of that leads back into this sort of cycle of, well, if you can't train as hard, then, you know, even if you do avoid injury, you're not training as hard, and you're sort of not now as what you were, because you're not training like you used to train. So I wonder, what is behind that not recovering well, and things that we could do? And of course, there's probably been many, many podcasts on this topic, but some of the high level stuff, I was just thinking that there's dumb stuff we do. Like I stay up late, I drink a lot of alcohol, you know, the dumb things that people do that interfere with your body's function. Okay. Stop doing dumb stuff, I guess. Yeah. But then there's other things that happen in aging, you know, like sex hormones fall. I am actually on TRT after fighting it and being against it and, you know, thinking it was, you know, I was just going to get it back up by trying hard and supplements. And it was just like, okay, I'm just being stupid now. and it has really made a difference. It wasn't like I always thought if I was taking testosterone, I would be, you know, like the Hulk. Okay, that doesn't happen. I guess I'm just not working out hard enough to take advantage of it that way. But it does seem to, like, tell my body to behave more like it did when I was younger. There's lots of effects of sex hormones, but one of them, I think, is that I recover more like I did when I was younger. And so anyway, I mentioned that. You can speak to that if you want. But are there other things that we can do that are sort of like, if you look at this blood marker, whatever, and if it's not what it was, then if you want to recover more like you used to, then you should do something about that.
Yeah. So look, there's a number of different things I'd circle back on now. So this first question of simply, if we took a bunch of 20-year-old athletes and compared them to a bunch of 45-year-old athletes and looked at the time course of recovery, to my knowledge, that study hasn't been done. And it's one of those pet projects that I would just love to do. The question would be, well, so if you see that the time course of recovery is slower, and we could add a group of 65-year-olds as well, you know, what explains that? And then you're getting into all kinds of molecular, you know, analysis and blood markers and so on. And maybe there's something is revealed there. Now, I've had a hunch about testosterone as well, and it's not something that I'm studying directly, but there's a colleague of mine, David Nolan, here, who's actively trying to get funding to study this. And his ideas around that, you know, you don't have to be on the very low end, you could be in the normal range for testosterone, but because the normal range is so wide, that maybe there are first of all, the deleterious effects of being on the low end without necessarily qualifying for therapy, and also with staying within the normal range with, you know, very mild, let's call it, TRT, that could confer some benefits. And it's very interesting to hear your anecdote. I mean, I would be curious to hear more people who have maybe experienced that. I suspect it is the case, just based on kind of all the positive things we're hearing at the moment. But maybe testosterone is just one component of the overall endocrinology piece when it comes to differences with age. So then going back to the question about recovery processes and modalities that we do, you know, I think we have to acknowledge what you started out with saying there, is that our lifestyles change as we get older. And, you know, the 25-year-old me and the 45-year-old me, the big difference there is more commitments from a work point of view, more late nights, kids, more commitments. You know, these are all things that would add to the so-called allostatic load, you know, which is a concept around, I guess, all of the insults, you would call it, in one's life that impinge on recovery. So I think there's that as well. So there's the environment in that sense, and then there's obviously the external environment, I should say. There's the internal environment. And then knowing all of that, we can still look at recovery modalities, whether it's sleep, whether it's protein, whether it's adequate carbohydrate fueling, rehydration, hot or cold, depending on which side of the fence you fall there, or both. For some people, hypoxia now is a new one. So, there's all of these different modalities that my sense is that they're, again, not well studied in the kind of middle age and older adult. My anecdote is that by far the most impactful recovery modality that I have used is a hot bath. And it's like when you were younger and it was like a grandparent would recommend an Epsom salt bath, you were kind of rolling your eyes going, what is this, a bath full of salt? But I don't think it's the salt, I think it's the heat. So I particularly over the last few years have found that 4-day recovery window that I talked about was kind of down to maybe 2.5 or 3 as long as I was doing hot baths soon after playing competitive matches. So again, that's just N of one anecdote, but it's one of those kind of tools in the toolbox that we can think about. But I think this stuff, the stuff around sleep and adequate fueling and stress, these are all factors that play into it as well. And it's, again, very different when you tot all those things up, comparing a middle-aged to a younger athlete from a recovery point of view.
Well, so everybody's going to be different. And if you're smart, you've been studying yourself and your blood markers, and you know what your issues are, and so you got to deal with those. I think some common things that we've all heard about, that maybe there's like a lot to it, but we can come up with a simple thing that a person could do. Like we talk about anabolic resistance, and the common prescription for older people is to eat more protein.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
Yeah, well, with anabolic resistance, the idea of eating more protein there is that you're overcoming the resistance. So again, to define it for your audiences, the anabolic resistance concept is referring to the idea that when we consume a bolus of protein, and typically that stimulates a process within the muscle called muscle protein synthesis, and that particular synthesis process is often, mostly it's in the context of muscle growth, but it's also used as a kind of a surrogate for repair or for adaptation, concepts such as that. So the anabolic resistance idea is that you consume the same, two individuals consume the same amount of protein, but one individual has a smaller protein synthesis response compared to the other, and that indicates a resistance to the anabolic effect of protein. So when the prescription is to eat more protein, that's to kind of overcome the resistance. An alternative view would be to exercise to increase the sensitivity, the other side of the equation. So when we've got, if we're getting back to your audience and what we're talking about here, if we're talking about people who are already quite physically active, the likelihood is they are anabolically sensitive. And I should also say anabolic resistance is not universally seen, by the way, in older adults. And there's some discussion about whether that is to do with baseline level of physical activity. So in different countries, in different cohorts, sometimes anabolic resistance is seen, sometimes it's not. And it might be just due to the fact that there's more physical activity in some cohorts than others. I mean, just, number of steps a day, for example. So I definitely would agree, there's no disputing, I think, the notion at the moment that older adults require more protein. compared to the RDA. I don't think there's anyone disputing the idea that athletes also require more protein compared to the RDA. Now, what that number is, people are probably asking, it typically lands around 1.5, 1.6 grams per kg of body mass. The older adult official guideline is 1.2 grams per kg of body mass. But I think when you layer in activity, exercise, the adaptation, growth repair, and so on, I think that 1.5, 1.6 target is a better one to aim for. So in the context of recovery, we usually talk about a certain portion of that being soon after an exercise bout, typically talking about a meal that's providing at least 20 or 30 grams of protein soon after exercise, and then the rest of it is spread out through the rest of the day in an even distribution. But as I always say, protein is one component. It's not a panacea. It's not the silver bullet that solves all problems, because a lot of us have tried to eat a lot of protein. It doesn't solve all our recovery problems, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely not a silver bullet. In fact, my experience is that there are no silver bullets. anything that is like a silver bullet would be like stupid stuff you're doing and you stop it, then that has a silver bullet type of an effect. I mean, if you're drinking a ton of alcohol, then it's totally interfering with your ability to recover.
Yeah, look, there's another anecdote that every person in their middle age will tell the same story, is that my hangovers are way worse when when I got to a certain age. I'd love if someone to study that and explain why that's the case, but everyone says it. So, it's one of those things we might not have the scientific study, but there's enough anecdote that, and what causes that? Is it metabolism, or is it just that we just don't sleep as much, or, we can't lie on the couch all day like we did when we were kids? So I'm not sure.
Yeah. But anyway, your body's telling you something. My body is telling me to stop drinking, so I'm listening to that. Well, so here's the issue with the protein thing. Make sure you don't have too little, but if we're already sensitive because to the anabolic response because we are active, then maybe we should be less inclined to overeat the protein, which I think drives people to overeat in general. They're always like, oh, I need a calorie surplus to recover, to build muscle. And if you're always in a calorie surplus, then you're going to be getting fat. In addition, if you're building muscle, you're going to be getting fat also. And so then other things that I think get involved in this, why is my body not working as well as it used to, is that I've got chronic inflammation in my body, inflammaging, I think they call it. Where does all of that stuff come from? Well, I don't really know, but I think having visceral fat and fat sort of in my organs is interfering with my body's ability to function. Is there truth in that?
Well, I think, there's no doubt that exercise is protective in terms of cardiovascular health, independent of body weight and body composition. Now, so what I mean by that is that, the ideal scenario, if we were to say, the person with the least risk is probably the lean individual who's physically active. But at the same time, we know that people gain weight as they age while still maintaining physical activity and meeting all of the guidelines. So I agree with you that I think if someone can get a lot of benefits from exercise and training by obviously participating, but if something about their lifestyle is such that they're gaining weight consistently over time, that's probably telling us that, that lifestyle could be improved. And if it's weight gain, and as you say, if it's visceral fat, it's probably at the level of excessive sugar intake or excessive alcohol intake. They seem to be the main drivers of fat deposition in that area, at least from what we know from a men's point of view. So I think that weight gain while also being highly physically active, that would be, we're talking about body fat gain here, particularly around the mid region. That would be indicative of a lifestyle that, there's room for improvement in, let's say.
Yeah. All right. And then another thing, which I think I totally have found it to be true for my body, and I think that it's just generally true, and that is that my tendons seem to just not be as reliable. They used to, like, nothing would ever bother my tendons. And now... I step off a curb suddenly, it's like, oh, now I've tweaked something. And so, something is happening to my tendons. And is there like something to do, like wall sits, isometric stuff, or, collagen with vitamin C? I mean, is there anything that we can do about our stinking getting old tendons?
Yeah, so I don't work in specifically in the tendon domain, but I have seen a couple of presentations over the last couple of years where that's specifically called out, is that there is a change in function in the musculotendinous junction, which is kind of what we're getting at here. And yeah, the tendons become, for want of a better word, a little bit more brittle. And as far as I know, there's nothing to say that we can change that from an aging point of view. I think when you bring up things like collagen, for example, that's largely to do with laying down new tendon rather than changing the properties of the tendon. And even when we say does collagen improve, say, tendon repair, the evidence is kind of shaky on that at the moment. But for a lot of, let's say we're working with elite athletes, for example, I work with younger athletes now I'm talking about here. Typically, if there is a tendon injury, even though the evidence might not be so strong on the collagen supplementation side of things, we generally will recommend it to those athletes because there's relatively little downside and there might be a possible upside. And, you know, as you know, athletes are willing to try anything if there's a slightest possibility of improvement. So, yeah. So that's one of those things. But I think to come back to your point about the tendons change, I think everyone can kind of feel that. You know, if I look back on any injuries that I've picked up in the last, say, 5 years, they almost all are at the musculotendinous junction. So rather than, you know, pulling a hamstring in the muscle belly, it's down at the lower end of the musculotendinous junction. And again, Achilles tends to be where a lot of middle-aged, you know, athletes who continue to train hard, that's the, you know, the fear, the biggest fear they have is Achilles tendon injuries. And people, for again whatever reason, it seems to be in the calves, that calf muscles, that a lot of people begin to feel those issues, particularly with endurance sport. So there's definitely something there, but unfortunately I can't give you a strong prescription on how to counteract that or how to improve things there, but yeah, except to acknowledge that it's another one of those aging issues we have to deal with.
Yeah, well, what I've picked up over the years is I understand that the tendons don't have much of a blood flow, so it's hard for nutrients to get in there. And the flow of fluids with nutrients happens when you're using the tendons. And so, you know, if you're going to go to the gym and lift weights where you're going to use your tendons, get some collagen floating around in your bloodstream before that. Yep. And I'll also have some first thing in the morning. And then I do wall sits, you know, 30 minutes roughly later, just sort of as a part of a normal morning mobility routine, just to try to do anything, because I don't know whether it's doing me any good. It's probably not doing me any harm other than the little bit of calories that I'm getting from it.
Yep.
But man, tendon injuries are terrible. They're the poster child for don't do too much, because then you're going to get an injury and then you're going to be done for a long time.
Look, the protocol you described there is what we use with practice as well. So that, you know, that's right on. And your rationale as well about why it should be done before training, that's all solid as well. To your point about the tendon injury, so that's why I think as people age, they move more towards things like machine weights or cycling exercise or ellipticals, because you're removing jumping, bounding, unexpected terrain, all the stuff that happens when we run and when we play kind of other sports. And that's a sad thing, really, that, you know, that we have to opt out of certain things we enjoy for fear of injury. But, you know, as I said to you, that is the number one thing that athletes I'm around at this age now worry about, is, you know, blowing out their Achilles, because everyone knows someone who ruptured an Achilles tendon. Now they can't even walk the same as they used to. And, you know, it's an amazing thing that, you know, people get through whole careers without any serious, say, knee or ankle, or in this case, Achilles injury. But, you know, that's actually, I wouldn't say that's, you know, the norm. It's typically someone will have one of those injuries. And as you say, if that leads to a you know, a period of inactivity or a loss of interest in training, or, you know, bad lifestyle choices, you know, out of kind of a, you know, for want of a better word, a depression around being injured. Like, yeah, that's the compounding effect that those type of serious injuries can have. So, yeah, best avoid it if we can at all.
Yeah.
Are we going to say anything positive here, Joe? Anyone's listening here is going to be like, what? These two guys, they need a shot in the arm or something more positive. Actually, yeah. I will just mention on your thing about the wall sits. So there's a bit of discussion lately around this idea of isometric training, because, you know, it has less of the eccentric component less of the explosive element. But at the same time, a lot of these prolonged holds and isometrics, if you hold them long enough, you do begin to recruit those type 2 muscle fibers that that we often don't recruit if we're doing low intensity work. So there's a lot of interest in this idea of slow movement, time under tension, super slow training, as it used to be called. You know, it was kind of popular a few years ago. And there does seem to be some benefit there because you're getting a good stimulus to the muscle while also minimal enough risk. So again, that's more credit to you on that one as well.
Yeah, yeah. And it doesn't injure me. And it cost me almost no time, so it just seems like a nice add to it. But this point of, you said people in trying to avoid injury or dealing with an injury, and then they sort of migrate to more predictable kinds of exercises. They're using machines that have, you know, limited range of motion or you know, limited dimensions of motion. Okay, that probably will actually help you to avoid getting injured at the gym, but it's totally not preparing you for then when you go out and play basketball with your son. And then you're going to get your Achilles injury because you have done nothing to prepare it for what, you know, kind of real life, you know, game type things, physical sports type things. So, you know, this gets into this, you know, the problem that I have had over the years that is, you know, I'm riding my bike and I'm lifting weights. I'm doing everything. No, that's not everything. That is, you know, you're getting some endurance. And you're getting some muscle building, maybe some tendon work. But, okay, what aren't you getting, Joe? Well, okay, so I haven't actually sprinted in about 25 years. Guess what? I went out and sprinted. I hurt myself. You know, it's like, of course I hurt myself. That's stupid. Why did you go do that? I mean, the problem is, why did I stop doing that? You know, the box jump or maybe the jump down kind of a thing. So, you know, this rate of this force, this, you know, rapid movements, rapid contractions, rapid relaxations of muscles, coordination, hand-eye coordination, or even like muscular, like running, all the muscles that have to work together in all just exactly the right moments. All of these things, these are skills that also fall into the use it or lose it kind of a thing. And if you don't use them, you lose them. And if you try to get them back later, it's way harder. So we get this problem of, you know, maybe you can speak to all of the things that we should try to hang on to, or each of us should say, oh, I don't care about my ability to run, or I don't care about my, you know, decide what you don't care about. All right, then. But I want to keep everything. So what are all of those things? And then how do I fit it all? How do I do all of it? You know, how do I do, you know, I'm, you know, riding my bike for 3 hours a week and I'm going to the gym for 3 hours a week and I'm, you know, and I feel like I'm full already. How do I get more time for all these other things?
So I'll start with the, that example that you gave around things like drop jumps or box jumps. I think it's an illustrative point because for someone who's never done those movements before, you know, it'd be inadvisable to, at the age of 65, to decide I'm going to start doing box jumps and drop jumps. Because that level of movement and that skill and that, let's say, intensity was not something that's in the locker. And sure, the tissue is probably not going to be ready for that type of an overload. Whereas it's something, it's funny you mention it about sprinting, because it's something I've been thinking about myself, which is that, you know, I still like to be able to sprint because that was part of the game that I played. And I, you know, more often now I train by myself if I'm not training with a team. And I kind of wonder, when will the day be that I do my last sprint? You know, it does, and I don't mean because I'm going to die. I mean, because at some point am I going to decide, actually, I've had enough of this. You know, this is too risky. But the thing about when you're training by yourself, let's say, and in this case, I'm talking more about maintenance rather than someone who's much older who's deciding all of a sudden I'm going to try and start sprinting again. So this is kind of the maintenance versus development idea. And I think when you have the component of fitness to train to a decent level, then you can just begin to sort of tailor back a small bit, with the view, of course, of maintaining stimulus, but, you know, not overdoing it. And that's a very different approach than the idea of trying to develop a component of fitness that you hadn't previously developed. So they're very different outlooks in terms of the way the training will be structured But then in also what the person might expect in terms of what they get out of training and how long it takes to recover and so on. So I sort of say all of that as a kind of preface to the question you asked about, well, how do you, you know, structure your training and what do you do to try and fit it all in? And I think the place that I tend to get people to start is thinking about, you know, it's probably two things at the same time. One is how much capacity or hours in the week do they have to train? And what are the primary movements and features of fitness that they'd like to keep, you know, with a view to, is it being able to sprint by yourself, you know, out in the field? Or is it to do with being able to play with kids in the garden, you know, playing football in the garden? I have three boys now and they want to play football all the time. And, you know, I want to still be able to run around with them. I can still do it right now, but will I still be able to do it in 5 years and 10 years? Hard to know. And that's a very different, I think this kind of gets to the athlete mentality again that we opened the conversation with, because sometimes you'll hear people talk about, you know, the great thing if as you age would be if you can lift up your grandkids, for example. But, you know, there's a few of us who would rather, we'd actually like to be able to run around the garden and play football and tumble, you know, so there's different outlooks that require different approaches to training. But I do think if we want to get into specific details, let's do that. But I think the broad brushstroke around, you know, how to decide at a certain age what to focus on is, you know, what are the features of fitness that you would like to maintain or you know, kind of accentuate, and how much time have you got to train? Once you know those two elements, then you kind of work backwards in terms of developing the training prescription.
Yeah, well, we don't really have time. We're about out of time. So I think that let's go into the, I want to hold on to everything, right? I want to be able to have
that's
a
not too much.
Yeah. I can't have max of anything, because if I go for max strength, well, then something's going to fall out. You know, if I'm going to go for max VO2 max, then something's going to fall out, because, you know, I could go for performance in a very narrow area. If, you know, if I have time constraints, because I, of course, have time constraints, and I also have recovery constraints, since that means I have training constraints. And so if I can put all of my efforts into one thing, or I can spread it out a little bit and try to do, you know, not be the best I can, not be the strongest that I could possibly be, but I can be strong enough. I can have enough cardiovascular fitness. I can have good enough coordination. I can have good enough endurance, you know, not only limited to the 1 hour workouts that I do. As a funny aside, I was doing 1 hour workouts for a few years, and then I went and did, I hiked up Mount Fuji. Of course, it took me like, you know, 5 hours. It was like, oh, this is going to take longer than an hour. I'm not trained for that. But because nobody knows if they're going to go hike Mount Fuji or not, I think my personal opinion is, you know, hang on to everything pretty good. And then you're ready to do stuff, you know, whatever comes your way, whatever adventure or life thing comes your way, or maybe it's just headroom for challenge. You got sick, you had to take care of somebody and you couldn't work out for a while or whatever. Hang on to everything that you can for as long as you can. And then you, so if that was the goal, then, you know, what is sort of like the least effective dose of exercise? You know, if I did it once a month, is that better than nothing? Or do I really need to kind of get it in once a week? Or, you know, do I really need, when I do my exercise, you know, and let's just assume that I worked up to whatever level I'm at, do I need to go to where I'm tired, like I, like nearly failure kind of a thing? Like I really feel like I did a lot on that particular thing each time I do it, but I'm not doing it all that often because otherwise I'm busy with all of the other things that I'm trying to fit in. Do I combine things where I'm doing, you know, I'm doing some cardiovascular in the morning and I'm doing weightlifting at night, or, you know, vice versa, because I just don't have enough days to do all my things. Do you know what I'm driving at here?
Yeah. And it's a lot of questions that I would say we don't have the evidence for, and come back to our question about the literature, but, you know, we can make kind of informed guesses about what it might look like. So if we think something, you know, the broad exercise guidelines are reasonable, you know, in terms of maintenance of health throughout life course, which is two strength promoting sessions a week plus 150 minutes of, you know, moderate intensity exercise or 75 minutes of high intensity exercise. there, you know, as best as I can see, those guidelines will do a lot of people a lot of good. What you're talking about is a little bit beyond that, which is like, you know, I've achieved a level of performance in certain domains of fitness, and I want to try and maintain that, or you know, maintain it better than just participating in exercise. So for that, we you know, you need a very well-rounded training program. And I do think that people enjoy certain types of training more than others. So that will be one factor that might lead. Yeah, so they'll do it. But if we're talking about, you know, the cardiovascular fitness, for example, then there's going to have to be an element of high intensity intervals. There's going to have to be an element of, you know, moderate intensity continuous exercise, zone two, as people are calling it now. From the strength point of view, obviously there's an element of where you want to provide enough of a stimulus that it can provide a little bit of muscle growth, because, you know, it may not produce growth, but it will at least maintain mass to a certain extent. But at the same time, you want to incorporate a certain amount of true strength and power movements as well. And so there'll need to be a bit of explosiveness there. Now, when you begin to put all of that together, it's your question, which is very appropriate, which is that, well, how do I fit all this in to my week? And again, it goes back to my earlier point about the amount of time that someone might have. And if they turn around and say, well, you know, I can only train three times a week, and I've got an hour each time I go to the gym, or, you know, I work out, then you are talking about combining sessions. You know, it's not a terrible approach to do a little bit of strength training for half an hour and then do a little bit of cardio for half an hour, or vice versa. Like, people might get into the weeds about, well, is there not an interference effect? Does one not affect the other? Does one augment the other? But we often run into this problem in exercise science and in kind of online discourse about the kind of the optimal. Is this the optimal? Is this the optimal prescription? And that's not quite the same as, is this the, you know, the best prescription for the individual and for their lifestyle and for the goals that they have. One other point that I would just make, which is a way of thinking about this, is this whole model of periodization. So, you know, if we're working with athletes, they periodize their training over the course of a season, which effectively means that it could be on an individual session level or an individual week or a month or a phase of the season. They will have slightly different things they focus on, with the ultimate goal is that they're all always gaining or maintaining in some component of fitness as the needs of the season or as the needs of the sport demand. And we often don't think about that either in older adults or in older athletes, this idea that, and I think you kind of touched on, is that we become worried that we're going to lose function in one element of fitness if we focus on the other. And I don't think it doesn't just disappear. You know, the use it or lose it concept is there, but, you know, if you're doing strength training that's got an element of, you know, let's say Metcon, metabolic conditioning as it's often called, that is going to have a maintenance effect on your aerobic fitness. You know, it's not that there's such a level of specificity or such a level of discounting that, you know, one doesn't impact the other. So I think this kind of more this holistic approach on a given week may be considered in the context of a periodized plan over the course of, say, 6 or 12 months. That's there to, you know, hit all the components of fitness, but then also to have enough variety and enough enjoyment in the program as well, without people feeling too constrained by, I might have missed a session or I might not have performed to my max in that session. You know, it should still be enjoyable and still be you know, worthwhile for people to engage with it.
That's helpful. Let's see. I think we talked about how the higher you can get your peak athleticism, you know, whether, you know, even talking about like bone density, but, you know, your ability to be an athlete, you've got various aspects of your physiology that contribute to that. And you're going to hit a peak at somewhere in your life, and then you're going to be on the decline and then focusing on maintenance. But the first thing to do is to get a high peak and try to make your peak as late as possible. You know, peaking a very high level at 18 and then declining means you got a long way to let that make that last. Whereas if you can peak at 40 or 50, then great. You know, now if you had a high peak at that age and you work at the maintenance, it could really last you a long time. So that is a sensible idea, I think. Then there was the notion of how to find that glide path, the maintenance part of it. You know, and I think we talked about it becomes more important to be more consistent, to have less gaps. And so that means don't get injured. You know, really, that would be a, you know, that's a that would be a very bad thing to do, especially, you know, like ligament damage, tendon damage, because they take a very long time to heal. So be very careful. And I think that that relates to, like, you know, when you're increasing your intensity, you increase it very gradually. You know, when you're picking something up new for the first time, like me going for sprinting for the first time in 25 years, maybe don't run as fast as you possibly can. You know, that turns out to actually be the mistake that I made. And, you know, and just gradually work yourself. So this progressive overload thing, when by overload, we mean just by a teeny, teeny bit, you know, and if you're at a very low level, then do just a little teeny bit over a very low level until you get better. And then you kind of work that way up. Again, you want to get better if you possibly can. And I think that you even maintain by trying to get better. Even if you can't actually get better, you're maintaining better by trying to get better, but very slow increases in intensity. Anyway, so good so far. Anything to add?
No, I think that's perfect. I mean, the maybe one point is that when we are pushing ourselves, that it is important to have those recovery days. Or, you know, again, in athletic parlance, we talk about deloading weeks, you know, in the periodization plan. It's, you know, there's a week where you can take it easy. You still train. And I actually should have clarified when I spoke earlier about, you know, say I played a match and I don't train again with the team for 4 days because my recovery is, you know, taking its time. That doesn't mean do nothing at all. That is things like, you know, non-impact training. So it could be swimming or water exercises. It could be cross-trainer. It could be more of the isometric type training that you're doing. So, you know, you can do lots of low level, let's call it, exercise and save your so-called big days or big weeks and so on. But I think your point about, you know, you don't make these huge spikes in activity or intensity. You know, it's all about small progressive overload and backing off when it's sensible to do so. You know, I think that's key as well.
Yeah, and that is a excellent point. What do you think is a decent, simple kind of periodization that would include like a deload week? You know, is it like a 4 week cycle where you're kind of going hard, harder, hardest, off?
Yeah, that's been the model. That's like kind of linear periodization, and it's again, it's it takes a little bit of thought about how you plan. So, you know, some people will just do the exact same session for 3 weeks, but in the style that you talked about, kind of ramping up over those 3 weeks, and then in the fourth week, deload it. Very similar session, but a lot less volume and intensity. And then they may either change the program for the next 4 weeks, or they may continue with the same program, but now they're a level again above where they started 4 weeks ago. So that typically is the periodization model. Like, there's lots of other undulating and non-linear periodization models, but that one where you're kind of ramping it up for 3 weeks, back off for a week, you know, that tends to work very well. But you could find someone, and again, my personal anecdote here is that for me at the moment, it's kind of 2 weeks where I can ramp it up, and then I have to back off for a week.
So it's a 3 week cycle.
I'm in a different cycle, and it's probably to do with the fact that in the team sport that I still play, we've an awful lot of accelerations and decelerations. And for me, that's become like the most obvious injury risk is that, because we use GPS monitors all the time now. So, you know, you get this readout of the number of accels and decels. And just, again, over the course of the last 2 or 3 years, I picked up patterns where once that volume gets to a certain level, I need to back off for a week, or it's likely to get injury. But again, that will be quite personal to different individuals and the type of training that they do. But, you know, something in the region of 3, 4, 5, 6 week cycles, you know, are probably the ones that people will naturally gravitate towards.
That makes sense. And how do you integrate nutrition into that? Because, you know, we talked about how you got to get enough protein for, you know, all of the things that you need protein for, but you don't want to overeat, you know, and if I need calorie surpluses to recover from my weight training to build muscle, well, I don't want a calorie surplus all the time. When do I take my calorie deficit?
Well, that could be the subject of another podcast, but I will try and keep it brief. The very simplest way we deal with this with athletes and, you know, across older adults across the spectrum is you scale up and down carbohydrate. Like, that's the easiest way to do it, so that, you know, protein and fat stay more or less constant across most days. and carbohydrate scales up when intensity is high and volume is high, and it scales down when it's not. So you have this, you know, it's a very simple model. It's it was developed originally in cycling, called Fuel for the Work Required, and it's kind of been translated into various different domains. But in team sport, you know, we have heavy days, moderate days, skill days that are lighter, and as I said, the overall kind of structure of a meal plan looks very similar day to day, but in terms of, as I said, in terms of protein and fat, but then the carb source, because often it's the easiest one to take, you know, if it's extra slices of bread or it's a larger portion of rice, or, you know, we're in Ireland, so I'll have to mention potatoes, you know, so it's, it's the carb source is often the easiest one to manipulate. And it's again, it actually does map to the demands of the exercise. So again, the more intensity of you're working out, the more carbs you tend to burn. So that's a simple model. So scaling up and down energy intake relative to the demands of the training day, and typically doing that by manipulating the amount of carbs consumed. So that's a 1 minute overview of a very complex topic.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was helpful. Thanks very much. Yeah. Okay. And so then I guess at the end, you kind of, a person has to figure out how to fit what they want in terms of their athletic longevity into their budget of how much time that they can possibly make to get that. And they shouldn't just, they probably shouldn't just focus on one thing. I'm not going to just ride my bike. You know, if you're just doing that, then you're going to get as good as you can at that. But then a lot of other things are going to fall away, and that'll probably, you'll be sorry about that, would be my guess. But you also will be subject to, you know, risk of injury. Now, I'm not on my bike and I'm doing, you know, I'm running across the street to, you know, get to the other side, and, you know, I pull something, or, you know, I stepped in a hole and my, you know, my joint wasn't ready for that sudden impact. And so anyway, I think that what I'm doing personally is that I'm trying to fit in a lot of different things. I think if I was doing like sports, like you're talking about, where I was running, you know, cutting, moving in all directions and sudden starts and sprints, it would be a very well-rounded bit of exercise there. My worry would be getting my body ready for that. But once I was doing that, I think that would be helping me a lot. Maybe I would need to do some other things, I'm not sure, like maybe some gym work, maybe upper body, you know, kind of stuff. But for me, because I'm not really participating in things like that, I've kind of got to manufacture it through, you know, gym stuff and, you know, field work, you know, all, running or, you know, moving side, you know, in different directions. So anyway, finding a way to fit it all in is the hard part. But you're saying that in each little thing covers a lot of ground, probably. No one thing is, you know, even riding my bike isn't just about my cardiovascular system. My muscles and my legs are getting a nice workout, at least in that range of motion. So, but be thinking in terms of how to put things together, or when you're tired and you're trying to recover, that maybe those are the times when you focus on things like my balance work or my coordination work, or, you know, the other things that I want to hang on to. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's a great summary. I think that the more components of fitness that we can target, the better, but we don't have to max out in every single one of those. So your bike example is a good one, that when people are younger and they're competing in cycling, you know, most of their sessions are going to be cycling based. Now there will be some benefits, as cyclists have learned over recent years, to doing strength training as a cyclist, but it's a small component of fitness. Whereas if we're talking about the, you know, the middle-aged and older adult, going back to my message about, you know, we can't always keep thinking that we're going to be, our best season is just around the corner. At some point there has to be a balance struck between continuing, again, to enjoy the thing to do, obviously, but also making sure that we're targeting all the different aspects of fitness. So again, it takes a bit of planning. It's not easy for people to do individually, and that's why obviously it's good to engage with experts in this domain. But I do think it needs a plan. It can't just kind of be, I'm going to turn up every week and just decide what I'm going to train for. You know, there does need to be a longer term plan.
Yeah, there's decision fatigue too. So, you know, if you kind of have a routine, maybe it's a seasonal one and you switch it up here and there based on the weather or whatever. But, you know, having something that you just sort of do without thinking, I think is helpful just to keep the load, you know, from driving you crazy.
Of course.
Okay. And then I guess the last thing that I'll just mention again is, you know, that with this problem with the recovery, which is sort of a key driver of why we do less and then aren't what we were, or one of the key drivers is the, you know, stop doing stupid things that are interfering with you. You know, if I'm trying to, you know, we already talked about alcohol and smoking, obviously, and, you know, maybe if I'm, you know, if I'm eating like a vegan diet, you know, I've really got to go out of my way to make sure I'm getting enough protein. I mean, there are things that you can do that are important to you, but you've just got to make sure that you're not undermining your other efforts. So, you know, staying up late and not getting good sleep. And I mean, probably if, you know, if we were talking about rules, you know, if one of the key rules was don't get injured, be careful, be patient, don't get injured. Another one has got to be get your sleep, you know, you know, be thinking that you should be getting 8 hours every single night and you should go to bed at the same time and get up at the same time and all of that for the person. And I hate these people. For the person who has no trouble sleeping and they sleep 8 hours like a baby every single night, and they're like, what are you talking about? That's so easy. I'm like, okay, I hate you. Get out of here. I want to talk to the real people. We all struggle with our sleep, you know, as we get older. And that is so important. And it is the worst thing because in everything else, you can try harder. You can just muscle your way through problems. Yep. But if you're not sleeping, you can't try harder to sleep better.
No. And you have to change, you know, change so much about your lifestyle. If you know, if there are things that keep you up late at night for, let's say it's work or social or, you know, whatever the case may be, and you're constrained on the other end because, you know, traffic is so bad at whatever time of the day that you need to be in the office, which means leaving, you know, so I'm, by the way, talking about myself here. So if someone asks, you know, you say all of that, I fully agree. I would say my average sleep now is 6 hours a night. And, you know, my wife will always, she'll see a headline that'll be like, you know, people who sleep less than 6 hours or whatever die, or, you know, it's a catastrophe anyway, whatever it is. And she's like, you know, you really need to start looking at this. And I'm like, oh, I know that. but at the moment, I can't seem to deal with it. But anyway, no, all joking aside, you're totally right. I mean, there are you know, enough studies out there that the point of the importance of sleep from a recovery point of view, that it is something that we should address. And it's probably the one thing that as we get older, thinking again, the younger athlete versus the older athlete, it's probably the one thing that changes the most that people struggle to deal with, you know, in terms of addressing for some of the reasons that I said there. So, yeah, it's a point well made. Maybe you just performed an intervention on me there that I need to start thinking about it again.
There we go. And I'll tell you, I'll just add in here just to you know, put an explanation point on this. I have just recently stumbled onto something that seems to be working, and I'm sleeping really well for like the last 3 weeks. Like every day I'm sleeping really well. My HRV is so good. My resting, everything, all of my health markers. It's like I'm a younger version of myself. Sleep, it makes a huge difference. I'm recovering so much better now. And it's in 3 weeks. So sleep matters.
Are you going to tell us what the secret sauce is?
That's going to be for me. Sorry.
No, that's good. It's good.
All right, Brent. Tell us how we can find you and any place else that you think people should, who have questions about this kind of older athlete stuff, should look.
Yeah, people can reach out to me directly by email. If you just search my name and DCU, Dublin City University, you'll see my contact details. I don't do anything on social media, so you can't contact me that way. But my research is all on ResearchGate or Google Scholar. Most of it's open access, so people can read it if they're interested. But I love having these conversations. So if anyone wants to reach out, please do. Email is the best way to get me, a bit old-fashioned like that. But yeah, hopefully we'll hear from someone.
Excellent. All right. Dr. Egan, thank you again. You're a great talker. I learn a lot from you every single time, and we'll have to do it again.
Thanks again, Joe.
All righty. Have a good one. Bye-bye. Thank you so much for joining my talk with Brendan Egan. You can find more information about Brendan and his research in the show notes.